Welcome to CXO 4.0 from Sullivan & Stanley. In our first podcast series, I'm going to cover a multitude of topics for business leadership in the 21st century. We will examine topics ranging from dysfunctioning boards through digital innovations, ways of working, interim and fractional working, and on to C-suite of the future. With technology on tap, what do our leaders believe this means for leadership roles? Okay, so today we're here to talk about introducing a startup culture within a corporate, and our guest today is Mike Sturrock. I won't try and introduce Mike. Mike, over to you.
Thank you, Ken. Hello. So, I'm Mike Sturrock. I'm the Chief Information Officer at Domestic and General Insurance. I'm also a member of the Board of Trustees that runs the RNLI. So I bring my technical expertise to the RNLI as well as my maritime expertise. I've been in technology now for 30 years, but prior to that, I used to be a professional yacht captain, so I've sailed all over the world and still do, and I bring the maritime and technical skills to the RNLI.
Fantastic. Thank you. What an interesting career before IT. That's fascinating.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And people frequently ask me, well, why did you ever leave the sea and go and work in an office? Sometimes I ask myself that too.
You must be itching every weekend to get away.
I am pretty desperate to get back on my boat, that's for sure. I am listening to Boris with bated breath for when he allows us to go and mess about with boats.
Yes, absolutely. Right. So startup culture within a corporate, lots of things to discuss here, lots of ways of approaching this. So keen to understand what you've experienced so far. I guess looking at what kind of organization you can put in place, you know, whether you separate something as an incubate it, or whether you have an acquisition of some kind, build the team in-house another way. Be really good just to understand how you approached these things in the past.
Okay. Well, a bit of the background to that is, I guess, I've been in a number of different industries. I've made sure that I've cast my career net quite wide. So I've been in a lot of different industries and started up initiatives within those companies, within those industries. And I guess it all depends on what it is you're trying to achieve. I've created separate organizations within a corporate. We've acquired businesses as well that we've kept separate. In one case, I had an initiative which was ended up with four companies in a long chain. And the one at the end of the chain was causing problems. And in the end, I purchased the company at the end of the chain and brought them in-house and basically made it a circle rather than a chain. And and then kept them separate. So I put them in a different office, let them maintain their culture, measured them on output, not on the corporate activity. So I think it depends on on what you're trying to achieve. I think we'll come on to some of the challenges of each of the different models. But if you keep it separate, I think that in my experience, that gives you the best run in, maybe not the cheapest way of doing it, because you're going to have to double up on skills and resources potentially. An incubator, I think, only works if you're doing it regularly. So you've got to have an incubator culture that says you're going to be doing it multiple times. The incubator has a framework of services it provides to the startup, and you only put that in place if you're going to do many of them. So the way in which I've done that before is I've used an external incubator to incubate something that I'm trying to achieve within my corporate. Right. So you're putting it with the incubator with a set of success criteria and investment around it. And they provide all of the sort of, you know, the nature of an incubator is it provides critical services to the thing it's trying to keep alive.
Yes. And in terms of in-house teams, have you tried to convert any in-house teams that maybe you needed something done in a different way or more quickly?
Yes, and definitely done that. And it then brings to some of our other points, I think, further on about the challenges with it. But yes, I have created those teams out of individuals within the organization and moved them separately to work in a different way. I think the challenge with that was twofold in my mind. One is, who do you select to be part of that? Who should be in it? Who isn't going to be in it? And then who else do you bring in from the outside? So you want the subject matter expertise from within the company, but you need the right values and behaviors that go with that. But you probably also want external input. You don't want pure company think, or you're unlikely to get the thing you're trying to achieve. So you do want some external you know, people to ask the dumb questions, people to ask, well, why can't we do it that way? Or people who have a different view of the market or of adjacent markets, whatever it is that you're looking at. So you need to create that mix of both internal subject matter expertise and external input, and then creating it in a physically separate space, in my experience, also helps then to get the people to start thinking differently than the parent corporate does.
And that probably answers some of the next question, which is around how do you make the best team? Is it made up of internal staff because of the knowledge of the business? Is it partnering? Is it cross-business, i.e. not just IT?
Definitely. Well, yes, I think I've answered a bit of it, but I think there's one word that's missed that I haven't used yet, and it's the sort of thread through the whole thing, is leadership. There's got to be leadership. That's both sponsorship, who wants it done, but also day-to-day leadership. Who is setting the tone? Who is pushing forward the initiative? And we'll come on to that. I think the best teams are ones that are mixed. So I say subject matter expertise in the company. If what you're trying to do is, you know, alongside the existing company, maybe a new route to market or a new product that's alongside the products or services that the company already provides. So you do need some subject matter expertise. And that's from the company, but you do need the external that says, you know, this is the way that, for instance, digitally you might handle this, or this is the way you might go into a new foreign market that you know the startup is trying to achieve. And so you combine the two, but then you have that leadership, that day to day, the director, whatever the title is, to whom they all look. Has the vision, has the passion, has the leadership ability to bring all those people together, not have them slip back into the corporate ways of doing things, allows them the free rein, manages all the conflicts and the politics and so on that might go on with the main corporate about how they're doing it, and allows them to get to a predefined set of success criteria. Because the big challenge here is, well, when do you know whether this is going to be a success or not?
Yes.
How long do you let this go for before you you decide, yeah, this is there's some legs on this, or no, we need to try something else?
And typically, where has the sponsorship come from in your experiences? Are they both from within the business and IT, or IT and other parts of the business?
Sorry, I didn't really answer the question on IT. I think I'm looking at this as an entire business challenge, yes. not IT. So I might drop the words IT now and talk about technology. Technology and change in the case of my department now. It should be, in my mind, if it's a route to market, it's a new product or it's a route to market, it's either the marketing director or the CEO. If it's a new route to market with an existing product or service, then it's probably the marketing director who is the sponsor. If it's a whole new market entry, then it's probably the chief exec, because it touches the entire company and it needs that level of kind of horsepower to make sure that it happens. But it's got to be that level. It's got to be that level. And it shouldn't be the CIO, I wouldn't have thought. We are your main supplier, as it were, into that, but not the sponsor, not the sort of owner of the vision, I wouldn't have suggested. So, for instance, in digital, you could say, well, digital is a CIO-type role, but I would argue digital is a method of getting to our customers, and so it's down to marketing. It would be the ownership.
And we've seen this debate many times, the movement from project owners to product owners. I'm guessing mm-hmm. the way you're speaking, you're in the product owner camp.
Definitely in the product owner camp. I think that's the product ownership. There's a real skill to it. I've seen some really good product owners. I know what good looks like now in that area. Take me a while to really understand it properly, but I've seen good product ownership, and I absolutely support it. It flows well into the whole Agile and DevOps way of delivering things from a technology point of view, but you can also move those methodologies into other areas as well. I think definitely the product owner, who might also be the leader I talked about earlier for the overall enterprise, but it could be just one of the senior people in the team. There might also be project owners as well, as in there might be big heavy lifting pieces of work to be done that to achieve the vision of the product owner, and they might be carved up into projects which are then given to slightly more classical project type activities. So, for instance, in my current business, we are about to launch in a new country, and so we're going to have to engage contact centers in that country. So there's a project to go out, do an RFP, find them, find the right one, start engaging. And that's not an iterative process. That is just a project that he's doing. There's other bits, technology-wise, that are iterative, but the finding contact centers, that's a project. Carve it out, get it done.
And I know you weren't expecting this question, but from a product ownership point of view, what are those traits that you talked about that make them, set them aside, the good ones from the average?
I think it's that the good ones really understand the market they're in and the product they're trying to deliver, and are able to flex. So they don't just have a rigid roadmap that says in a year it'll do this and in 18 months it'll do this. They're attuned to the market that they're trying to hit, the customers they're trying to get to, and they're able to then iterate, the same as the technology and other teams are able to iterate and go, right, in the next sprint, the next half a dozen sprints, we want to achieve this capability, which will take me in this direction. We'll then test and learn, and then we'll move to the next one. And so that's been the best behaviors I have seen, is that ability to iterate, but be attuned to where the market and the customers are. And like all of these skills, it comes down to the ability to engage, be able to work with, collaborate, negotiate. They'll always want more than the teams can deliver. So, right, which bits of the backlog are you going to deliver this time? All of that. Personal skills as many as technical skills.
Yes, quite. And interesting in the context that we're talking around startup culture in the corporate organization, I guess they have to almost be like a PLNO, an L owner, understand what it means to be able to move at pace to make sure that holds up. Interesting on the reporting lines front then, how does that work?
Now, if the culture's right, if the culture is truly sort of one team, it shouldn't matter that much. And certainly in my current organization, in Domestic in general, we've been very good at that. So I have multiple teams who are embedded across the company. And in fact, people aren't quite sure who they report to. Do they report to me and through my structure, or do they report into another exec member of the exec team? And we blur those lines purposely because we've got the culture, I think, in the right place. That, in my experience, doesn't always work. If it's not going to work, then in a particular culture, then my recommendation, as always, the reporting line's got to be into where the value is being created. So it would be in a startup. If there's this startup, then the reporting lines are all in that direction. So you try and cut through the conflicts of interest a bit and the dual reporting, and they're absolutely focused on the outcome for the startup.
It sounds like D&G are quite advanced in their thinking. I don't mean futuristically. I just mean many companies struggle with this idea of creating virtual teams of different business departments. It seems like you guys have overcome that.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's overcome. It's one of those things that you can constantly work at, and it comes from professionalism, leadership, and relationships. So, at the exec level, the relationships between us are strong, and so, for instance, we have a chief digital officer now. We've just appointed, so he sits alongside me as chief information officer. Now, the digital team is 2/3 report to me, and 1/3 reports to him. But he and I are tight on how we're doing our digital transformation, and we work in lockstep. So there's no conflict of interest between us. Therefore, our teams aren't battling each other. They're absolutely focused on the outcome. Yeah. So I think we've worked hard at that, and you have to continue to work hard at it. As I say, yes, I would agree. I've been in my organisations where that doesn't work, and that can be really inefficient then.
Yeah, that can be really tough. And leadership, if it's not aligned, the rest is broke. We know that.
So
you need.
Yeah. So unfortunately, culture comes from the top. Other things come from the bottom, but culture, the tone, the culture, the behaviours come from the top.
Yeah, following through on what you say in particular.
Yes, indeed.
And so, this is probably the more grindy side of things. So as we look at trying to create this startup mentality in whatever guise. You have to think about, as you said right at the beginning, you know, what are the goals? How do you distill those into objectives? And then finally, how do you measure progress against those? Tricky when you're potentially innovating.
It is tricky. And I think that there's a few things that you could start to measure. For instance, you don't go into it, I guess, with absolutely no idea what it is you're trying to achieve. So you'll have some sort of vision and you go, okay, we're going to put 100,000, say a million. We're going to put £1 million into this. But there's your first measure. We're going to spend this much money. You might have measures that say we're going to deliver this much functionality in this much time. And another measure might be we're going to have this many customers in this much time. And maybe we've got this much revenue coming in, maybe. And you can start to chart and measure your progress on all of those measures over time and say, within a year, I want to have spent £1 million. I want to have delivered 1,000 story points. I want 100,000 customers, and I want to have made, you know, 100 grand or something in revenue, no profit. So you create those measures and then you start measuring yourself towards them. And maybe in 6 months' time, you go, well, are we likely to hit those measures or not? Do we need to course correct? Are we never going to hit them? Is there no legs on this and we should think again? We're on course. In fact, we're on course for double those figures. So, you know, let's absolutely go at it. But I think it's those kind of creating those measures, whatever they are, I've just made those ones up. Yeah. But creating those gives a focus for the team and the passion to drive for it. I think the other thing, though, is, and this is crucial, is that absolutely from the top, from the chief exec down, there is no blame if it doesn't work. Because if there is a sharp cliff coming, if this doesn't work, then that'll drive probably the wrong behaviours within the startup. The nature of it is it's exploratory. It's the wild frontier. That's the whole kind of idea of it. And you should celebrate the fact that people are exploring that frontier. If they come back going, there be dragons, or there's no money in that direction, customers aren't interested, whatever. Right, well, at least we've learned something from that. So if in 6 months' time you're halfway through your year's money or whatever, if the leadership of the startup come back to the board and go, don't think it's going to work for these reasons, that should be celebrated as a good thing. And so, right, okay, well, what should we do? And you know, hopefully the leadership will have come back and gone, we shouldn't do this, but we should do this. And that all of that behaviour should be celebrated and supported, because if it's not, then there'll never be another startup, or at least not in that sort of cycle of leadership in that business, because everyone will have seen what happened to the last lot. So you've got to set up the tone.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about that. One of the things that's really difficult is when you create an environment like that, for all of us to be patient with the idea that there's going to be some failures along the way, but also people are developing, and you can measure that development in the people in the team, and that itself is valuable.
Yes, and of course, with DevOps capabilities now, the tooling and the sort of methodologies and ways of working, you are able to measure velocity and defect leakage and things like that. Certainly, from a technology point of view, you can do that now, and so you know, an organization could see itself speeding up. But this is more about: are we creating value? Is this creating something? And certainly in the case of digital transformation we're doing at Domestic in General, we have a lot of KPIs that we measure about how many people are able to make a claim online instead of using our phone service, how many people can manage an engineer visit, a product replacement, how many renew online, and so on. And we watch all of those measures and how many people drop out partway through, and then we find out why and we fix that so that they don't drop out next time. And it's a continual process of tuning and developing the capability to push those measures the way we want them.
And do you think the startup culture in a corporate is not too dissimilar to a startup in the first place, in the sense that you have to accept some of those things you've talked about? You will engage in a test and learn or minimum viable product type approach to maintain the pace, to maintain the independence that you talked about earlier. It feels like you can't really call it a startup unless some of those things are true.
I think that's right. And I've had the equivalent of a couple of startups going on within Domestic in General right now. But there's two other red lines I've put in place for those. I've said there's two things that I will not compromise on: security and compliance. We're a financial services business.
Yeah.
We can't mess with cybersecurity. No organization can, regardless of financial services. No, that's got to be a red line for everybody. You design in cybersecurity from scratch, because you can't mess with that. In financial services, it's around compliance. You know, we can't do anything that's non-compliant. So within those two red lines, then you could get at it and see what you can do.
Yeah, fascinating. Rather like any large change program, you want to know the guardrails, that the principles that you just can't change for whatever reason. They are the things that guide you through.
Yes, yes. So, for instance, in cyber, you design in security at the beginning, you don't add it on afterwards. So you have those principles in place. And when I've had development teams before, going way back to 20-odd years, when the technology was very different, we'd have the 10 principles pinned up on the wall.
Yeah.
Right. Everything from this is the naming conventions for files, for instance, to, you know, you'll have no SQL code in your presentation code. You'll separate out presentation layer from business, from data access layer, and so on. All those kind of principles. And it's much more elaborate now around things like least access, minimum privilege, all of those kind of things that are designed in at the beginning. Yeah. And so even if it's a startup, I think some of the and the tooling now with all of the cloud platforms helps greatly with getting those things right from the start without having to do it all from scratch.
And I think this is one of those areas where actually having a corporate organization wrap itself around a startup mentality enables you to not make some of the mistakes a typical startup starting completely independently would make, which is around things like security and test-based coding and all that kind of all those other things that corporates have been learning over years and years. It's a lovely blend to be able to say these are the guardrails and principles which will enable you to actually accelerate even more given the independence we're giving you.
Yes, I think that's all right, and I think the tooling really helps. I think it then comes on to if it's got legs on it and it does go, then and it starts to grow, then of course the corporate will want to put some more controls around the thing.
Yeah.
And in my experience in the past, and I think I've seen it with some of the dot-com startups. So I was an IT director of a dot-com back in 2000. And now some of those dot-coms, the ones that survived that whole period, are now in a position where their technology platforms are legacy. They're struggling because they were built in a startup mentality in older technologies. And they're now spaghetti. And they're really struggling. And the new startups are eating their lunch because they're coming in with cloud-based solutions that can be developed rapidly on a much more robust architecture. And so the positive for now is if you've got a startup and you do it on one of the modern cloud platforms, you've got a better chance of being able to productionize it if it starts to grow in a big way than you would have had in the past. But you do have to start wrapping some of that service and cyber and monitoring and all the rest of it around that if it starts to grow. And that's where the corporate might start to move different resources into the team. Say the end of my example of a year, you've hit your KPIs broadly, the next tranche of investment goes in, and part of that investment might be, all right, we need to get some service and operations people into the team now and start turning it into a bit more of a, you know, an ITIL 4 type environment to run the thing, and then we'll have, you know, we'll start to grow the thing. But there will be a change of different types of skills and outlooks needed as you move from a startup into sort of a growth company.
And interestingly, I think some of the challenges face that you would have faced in those. There's a couple of questions here. One is, it sounds like you can run more than one startup or incubated type of thing. At D&G, is that typical for you guys? How many would you run typically?
Well, some of them would, from the outside, you'd see them as projects. And I've got upwards of 60 different initiatives underway at the moment. Some of them are big, and they would class as a startup. New country rollouts with new technology and new ways of working. And so we've got several of that, three of those going on at the moment. And actually, we put them on ice at the beginning of this crisis, but actually we're thawing them out again now because we think we can still work over Microsoft Teams and the like. So we can create those, but I come back to, if you get the culture right, if you've got the culture and the leadership right, then you can achieve it.
And I think the second part is around the challenges faced. So one assumes that when you're running that many, potentially you have resource challenges, you have priority challenges. It'd be interesting to hear how you...
Well, yes, that is very true. And I think in the end, you have to make a choice between trying to be really cost efficient, as in you're going to split people, time slice them between things, or you care more about the outcome. If the value to be created is so high that it's worth being a slightly inefficient, maybe, in the way in which you allocate resource, we're going to have a full-time, squad, development team on this project and another full-time team on that project, rather than try and split in between, which might mean the two startups end up going slower, then that is really a choice to be made. And I've balanced that in the past and balancing it now, where we put full-time resources on something, say digital transformation, the value is so high, it's worth investing heavily to get there quickly and not have the resource conflicts and not have people time slicing between things.
And how on earth do you handle the jealousy? Because I imagine there's this new, fancy, well-funded bit of work going on over there, and I'm over here doing some sort of iterative change that's been done before. You know, how do you manage people's expectations around those sort of things?
It's probably slightly flippant to say it does come down to leadership again, and some fairly plain speaking.
Yes.
So if the people are it's plain speaking. If you make the selections, who do you want in that team? And again, it'll be the subject matter expertise and their thinking, their ways of working that you want. The people who aren't going in the team, you need to manage their enthusiasm, their commitment. And it might be that if you've got enough of these things going on, they get the next one. But sometimes that again, plain speaking, you might have to say, look, sorry, you're not the right person for this. And not sort of jam tomorrow conversation with them. It's that no, you're not the right person for this. We think your skill set and your focus is this. Now, they might not like that, and they might choose to walk. But my approach has always been to be much more direct with people and try and support them rather than give them a soft flannel. Yeah. So be really clear with them and have a development conversation. If, for instance, I thought about someone to not be in the startup team and they went, I really want to be. Why do you want to be? Where do you want to go in your career? What skills have you got that I've not seen that mean you think? And some of those conversations have come round to a complete change of direction for the individual where they've gone, oh, I see what you mean. No, I suppose I don't have that thinking. And I said, do you want to develop it? In which case, you know, here's some resources to go and think about. Or they might go, yeah, you're right. Actually, that's not my bag. So either way, or they're able to persuade me that actually, no, I've missed something about them. They have their capability. All right, thank you for that. I will now factor you in. I think you've got something to offer. So it can go one of three ways, but it always starts with a plain speaking conversation.
Yes, of course. And this next question is probably my favourite. Like you, I've been in this industry over 30 years and I've seen enough of this, but I'll be interested in your view, which is with these kind of innovative startups, you know, outcomes are not guaranteed. How long does one give it before it calls it a day? You know, how much do you plummet into something with,
yes,
you know, advice you're getting from the team even who are still keen for it to be success, but you have to look at it with reality at some point.
You do have to look at reality. And I come back to those measures at the very beginning. If you started it up and said, I'm going to give you £1 million, I want to see, you know, this many customers in a year's time, and I want to see you making this much revenue. That's the measures. You get this much from me, you've got to do these things. Then at least they've got something to aim at. And if they don't hit it at the end of the year, then they've got a conversation coming that they know about. If they've made, you know, they spent £1 million, but then they've got, you know, 9/10 of the way there, with the number of customers and the revenue coming in, for instance, you might go, well, you're nearly there. That's pretty good. Let's keep going. You know, it's not a hard and fast thing, but it gives a target for everyone to head at and a framework for the conversation if you're going to disband it.
Yeah.
And in fact, you wouldn't wait a year anyway. You'd see the trajectory and you'd say, you know, are we doing the right thing here? And of course, the minimum viable product and iterate and learn means you can course correct throughout that year. And to try and hit the mark, and you'll be having the dialogue the whole time. But back to my point about the search for the search for the guilty and persecution of the innocent. If you decide to bin it, because if you do, if you, for instance, you know, you vilify the people who are involved in it, you know, they made mistakes, they didn't do this, didn't do that, whatever, then there will never be another startup in that business. Certainly not in, you know, in the corporate memory of the company, because they'll see what happened to the last one. If it doesn't work, you get the learnings you can from it. You've spread those learnings around the business. You celebrate the effort, the people involved in it, and you move on and find another frontier to explore.
That's so true. I wish all organisations could see that. You know, in particular, all those learnings, even how you approached it, even if you didn't get the outcome, you would have learned so much in how to approach and tackle problems like this.
Yes, you would. You would. And you've grown the corporate skill set. Of everyone. So if I was leading one of these, we all learn. Every day's a school day, right? We'd all learn. And you harvest those learnings as you go. For instance, I'm sure every company's done this, who's done well at it. The move to working from home during the beginning of lockdown, my services team moved heaven and earth and moved 3,500 people home within 8 days. At insane effort, we were buying laptops in Argos and PC World. Argos is a customer of ours, so we were able to get laptops, cheap ones, but we got them, configured them, got them out to people. All those things were happening. I'm sure thousands of companies were all doing the same. And so when the dust settled and we got, all our contact center agents home, all our office staff and so on, we then started looking at it and going, blimey, we achieved a lot. What can we learn from that? What did we do? We took more risk. We spent a bit of cash. We worked around the clock. We had shifts working, configuring laptops, shipping them out and so on around the clock. What can we learn from that? How can we how can we use that approach again when the chips are down?
Very true. There's a startup right there. How you just do things completely differently.
Yes. How can you think completely differently? And, like that one about risk. So, okay, we took some more risks. We didn't risk cyber. We had our CISO involved all the way through to make sure we did. That was one of my red lines, still always one of my red lines. All right, we're not going to get all this kit out there to agents and then suddenly start leaking data because we've done something wrong. Let's not be too hasty. And so we thought through all of that. But within those guardrails, we moved heaven and earth, as I'm sure I know a lot of other companies did as well.
Yeah. And I guess then dovetails nicely into the next question, which is taking something like that or any other innovative idea and then seeing some of the green shoots or better, and turning it into something that then needs to be productionized or operationalized. And you referred to it earlier, that's potentially different teams. It's potentially a blend. But certainly there'll probably end up being some more rigor around service levels, et cetera, et cetera.
There'll be rigor around service levels, about billing and accounting practices or whatever to track the money, all of those things. And the trick then is to make that transition without strangling the life out of it. So you might have built it on a cloud platform when the main corporate platform is a legacy system. Maybe you've got to you've then got real architecture and service issues to deal with to make sure you don't, for instance, try and migrate it off the cloud solution onto a legacy. You might say that, well, this cloud solution is the direction of travel for the whole organization, say, and you'll then start charting out your route to make more use of what you've just built. But I mean, we're all talking hypotheticals because it depends on what situation, what company, what's the product, what's the service you're trying to provide. But it all comes down to that, to leadership, I'm afraid, again, at every level. From what we're talking about here is technical leadership, the head director of architecture, the CIO, the head director of service and so on, to have that vision for what are we going to do with this that both continues to grow it and doesn't strangle the life out of what's just been created.
And it's interesting what you say. It sounds like you've witnessed some startup technologies, particularly with things like cloud arriving as they did in the last decade, where that's actually switched the wider corporate technology approach, having used the startup for one outcome as far as a new market proposition.
Yeah.
But actually, it's also turned over some ideas around the underpinning architecture.
Yes, definitely. And without sharing too much, that's what we're doing at the moment at Domestic in General. It's exactly that. So I'm using cloud technologies for exploratory new countries for us to seed new capabilities within the main body of the company. So, yes, and those cloud solutions now lend themselves to that very well. And that's what we're looking to do.
And they bring along the automatic operations as well, that you don't need to suddenly find yourself working your way through. Your point around ITIL version 4 earlier.
Yes.
A lot of that, the weight has been taken away, thank goodness.
It has to some extent, absolutely. But I wouldn't I've had to battle against the view that, well, if you put everything to the cloud, you can get rid of the entire services team. And it's not... You can reduce it. You absolutely can. You don't have people sitting there looking at servers, managing operating systems, doing all of those things. Absolutely don't. But you do need a different set of skills. Less people, but different skills, but they do need to manage it. Everything from managing the contract and managing the instances and making sure that people aren't spinning up multiple instances and astronomic bills turning up, to capacity management and security management and all the rest of it that needs to be done. So there are skills still needed. It doesn't run itself.
I've seen an awful lot of other businesses over-index now on partner management for that very reason, whether it's cloud or as a service, is so much partner management involved.
Yes, yes.
And so once you've made these changes, you've gone through your startup, you've tried it once or twice, how do you then make that the norm? Is that the norm just for attempting innovation or change, or is it further than that? Can you actually make a wider business behave like a startup?
Yes, I think you can to some extent. So we are looking at that, as I said, after the success of the lockdown and the home working, what can we learn? How can we take things differently? Which projects don't need as much control and management on them? How can we give people more free rein? So the phrase I've always used, and I'm applying more and more here, is freedom within a framework.
Yes.
So you might give a team a framework that says you can take this much risk, you can spend this much money, I want this outcome. How you do it, up to you. If I trust in the team, the leadership of the team, the quality of the team, give them that framework and say, you know, get at it. And I think we are doing more of that now, and with less, you know, management by exception. Tell me if something's going to go wrong. Otherwise, I expect to hear from you once a month, kind of thing. So we're doing more of that, where we are having more of an appetite for risk if you've got the culture and the quality of the people who can manage that. It's a bit like in the days of Prince 2, you look at the manual for Prince 2, if you followed all of that, I remember when I did my Prince 2 exams, I was exhausted by the whole thing. I thought, bloody hell, if anyone works through the whole of this, you'll have a mountain of paper. But I guess it means that it doesn't matter what quality of people you've got involved, you will get something of value out. Not very much, it'll take a long time, but you will get something out. Now, every business has taken the view, well, we're going to cut corners, but we're going to have better people. And that's what I'm meaning. You have the right quality of people and the right culture. You can give them a framework and they can work within it.
It sounds a great environment. You're in the throes of creating, you know, that type of empowerment with some guiding principles that they can work within. It's just exactly what everyone looks for.
I think so, yes. And so that's what we do. I mean, it doesn't always work. Money isn't always there. There's always a limit on cash and people. So it's not in utopia, but then nowhere is.
Interesting. And so I guess the final is having seen and done what you've done, is there anything you would recommend or change for others? Are there any pitfalls you've come across and thought we had those challenges and they could have been handled differently, or actually there's a new way of working that I would recommend to others? Anything that through your own personal experience of using this?
If you'd asked me that 5 years ago, what I'd have described to you is now what I think is DevOps.
Right.
So I wanted that. I couldn't even articulate it in my mind, but it's now much more embedded, and it's DevOps. It's that way of working between the development and the operation that is driving huge values in not just in startup, but in our line of work entirely. So, and that comes down to, again, tooling, skills, and leadership. I would. It's probably the obvious is to go down that route straight away. Don't add that on afterwards. A bit like security is built in at the start, and use the tooling that's available. So if I'd had this conversation 5 years ago, that's what I would have wanted. And I think we're there now. But in the end, it does come down always, always, always to leadership. What's the vision? Do people buy into it? Is everybody bought into it? Or are you swimming against the tide? Because if you do, unless everyone's all behind the startup, they're hard enough as it is. If everyone isn't behind it, then it's destined to fail.
It's interesting, your thread of leadership through it. I couldn't agree more on my own personal experiences. And certainly, I actually don't think there's a huge difference in working in a startup or a larger corporate. There are some differences in the amount of resistance you have to deal with.
Mm.
In terms of the technical challenges, it's all leadership, as you quite point out.
Yes, it does. And yes, it's leadership at every level. And I talk to my teams about their own personal leadership. How are they conducting themselves? Not just, you know, what does my leader, what does my manager tell me to do, but how do I behave? How do I think?
And do you have a mechanism behind how you develop that with them?
We have obviously the structures of performance management and development plans for people. And in that, then we have coaching. We've tried various mechanisms between, you know, peer coaching, sort of cross department coaching, then external, and some training courses. We work on a sort of 70-20-10. 70% is on the job training. 20% is sort of work shadowing or coaching, and then 10% is external courses and you know, more formal training. So we mix all of that together to try and give people the skills that they need and keep them retained, you know, retain our good talent and develop it and grow it.
Fantastic. Mike, that was really interesting and such great insight. Thank you very much for your time and particularly sharing your experiences, which I know will be useful to others. So, well, again,
very welcome. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Change Society podcast. Sullivan & Stanley is an award-winning specialist change consultancy that deploys expert teams to solve the challenges companies face when undertaking change. To find out more, please head over to our website, sullivanstanley.com.